You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. You'll recall, day before yesterday, I believe it was, the first time that we shared with you the audio clip that Joe Madison and the great folks and his staff and over at SiriusXM had basically, you know, just brought out of the audio. George Zimmerman muttering a racial epithet under his breath. And we talked about this through most of the show yesterday, the day before yesterday, And today, Joe Madison is on the line with us. JoeMadison.com is website. The radio host, 6 to 10 a.m. on Sirius 128. And Joe, welcome back to our program.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you just fine. Are you in Sanford today?
Yeah, we are. Actually, let me tell you what has happened. I just landed in Orlando, Florida, and I get off the plane, and I get this this emergency email that tells me that we got to get to Sanford quickly because they were planning to have the rally at a church, the First Shiloh Missionary Baptist Church, which, you know, is a small church. I'm not certain if it even holds 1,000 people. Well, guess what? They just changed this rally to a park, which, because they expect 20,000 people to show up within the next 2 or 3 hours. 20,000 people. I know that the city manager, and you're going to have to take a look at this because we'll be en route to Sanford, but the city manager probably right now is holding a news conference. I do not know what he's going to be saying, but they're really keeping it hush-hush. Supposed to be a major announcement. But this is significant because we had planned to broadcast live. We still will. I mean, we will broadcast live. But we were thinking that we would be in a medium-sized Baptist church in Sanford, and it's now been changed to an outdoor venue, and they're expecting 20,000 people. So
Joe,
this obviously has grown.
Yeah, it clearly has. And I said on this program a couple of days ago, and have repeated it many times. If Trayvon Martin had been a 17-year-old white girl, and George Zimmerman had been an African American man, this Nancy Grace would have been all over this story. She has not mentioned it on television once, to the best of my knowledge.
And let me tell you what else has happened. Today we did a story where Glenn Beck, I try to forget him, Glenn Beck, his log is somehow suggesting that Trayvon may have been violent or a violent person. Because he had been suspended from school for tardiness. I kid you not.
Jeez.
I kid you not.
Well, Joe, this...
I mean, that is what's going on Fox and these right-wing talk shows.
And this raises a larger issue that I'd love you to speak to, that frankly, and you know, I think most African-Americans don't realize this, but I don't think that... I'll bet the 90% of white people in America who have grown up in white communities do not know what the phrase white privilege means. And if I'm serious, Joe.
And no, I know you're serious, and I'm saying, in other words, I agree. You're
absolutely
100% correct.
So speak to that, you know, the experience of growing up in America, African-American, and the perception of how different it is to grow up white.
Well, I mean, look, it's very simple. I'm telling my son exactly what my father and grandfather told me growing up an African American, and that is, one, you got to be twice as good to get the same position. There's no ifs, ands, buts about it. You cannot act a certain way. Can't walk around with your hands in your pockets. You can't walk around with a hoodie. I have to tell my son growing up in Montgomery County, Maryland, when you go out with your white friends, remember, you're the target. You're going to be the target. Be careful when you're driving, because driving while black means that a police officer might follow you for a couple of miles to get the license plate to run. a check on you for no other reason. Look, man, I lived in outside of Philadelphia to give you a in a nice community because the radio station I worked for was a few blocks away. I wanted my kids to have a really good school system, and I literally had neighbors when I would jog, because I worked from midnight until 5:30 in the morning, the overnight shift. So I would walk and jog and exercise when most people were at work. Well, guess what? I had neighbors who would call the police on me. And they would stop me and ask me, what are you doing in this neighborhood? Now, let me tell you, I don't know any white guy that walks through a black neighborhood or a white neighborhood and is asked, what are you doing in the neighborhood?
Right.
I mean, white privilege is something where a George Bush can get into a college in Yale based on legacy, and yet that's not considered affirmative action. And then you get the people like, Professor Skip Gates of Harvard. The law professor, Ogletree, Harvard Law School, distinguished professor. Ben Carson, the renowned brain surgeon. These are young African American men who got into school, yes, because they were part of affirmative action program, and now look what they're doing. But yet, individuals who probably had lesser academic achievement, and you had people who would sit in the same class. Tom Hartman and I could sit in the same freaking class at University of Michigan, Michigan State, where we both live,
mm-hmm.
and someone could say, well, Joe's there because of affirmative action. But guess what? You know and I know, they have to give us both the same test. They don't hand me an affirmative action test.
Yep.
They give me the same exam that they give you. This is what white privilege is all about. And what has really captured everybody's attention is the fact that this is not an isolated incident. This is what people need to know. That's why you're seeing a protest in New York. There's going to be one in D.C. They're all over the country because there are tens of thousands of Trayvon Martins. And I'll tell you something else I said this morning. This flies in the face. This flies in the face of Santorum and Gingrich having the audacity to go into Iowa and say that there's no culture of marriage, that there are no black role models. Well, there's going to be about 20,000 freaking role models in Sanford today. And the people that call my radio show are black fathers who will call and literally cry on the air because they have a 17-year-old son or they've got a nephew. So, you know, this today, and I'll say it today, and I mean this, this is 21st century Emmett Till.
I was just going to ask, is Trayvon Martin this generation's Emmett Till?
That's what it is. Why was Emmett Till killed? Because he supposedly whistled at a white woman.
Right. Well, 1954.
He was killed because he was considered a threat, whatever that threat was. Now remember, they eventually prosecuted and put those men on trial. They were acquitted, and the very minute after they were acquitted, they walked outside and did an interview and said they did it. I am very frightened and afraid, really, that Zimmerman may very well get off. And what really disturbs me is why the media, you speaking of Nancy Grace and these others, why the media does not want to deal with this, what we found on that 911.
Well, and Joe, even beyond that, I mean, let's say that they take George Zimmerman and they put him in jail for the rest of his life. He's one of thousands.
Well, you're right, and you're absolutely right.
Who
and
will not be prosecuted.
State. You have a state, Tom, and I hear the music, and I'll let you go, but you have a state, Tom, that it shoot first. The state of Florida is a law where it says shoot first. This man would have shot Mickey Mouse if he'd had a hood on.
I think you're right. Joe Madison, joemadison.com. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more on the Trayvon Martin case and other things in the news here as well. Stick around.
Is it evil that makes men such killers? Some race or religion we hate? Is it the rich and the poor locked in a war? Is it fear? Is it rage? Is it fate?
So the closer we look at Paul Ryan's budget, the uglier it gets. He wants to not only give tax breaks, $3 trillion worth of tax breaks to the top 1%. He also wants to sell off a whole lot of public land in a whole bunch of Western states at super cheap prices to those same multimillionaires, billionaires, and transnational corporations. Isn't that sweet? Cut welfare, sell off public lands, use the money to give to billionaires. Amazing. And meanwhile, President Obama has authorized fast-track approval. In fact, gave a speech about it this morning, saying that, you know, the real problem is not, you know, the Republicans are running around going, we're not drilling enough, we don't have enough oil, we need the Keystone Pipeline. He says, that's not really the problem. The real problem has to do with the fact that we're not really seriously taking seriously the energy problem in the United States. We're not looking at conservation and renewables and all kinds of other things because, you know, we're doing the oil thing. I mean, you know, here he is just blowing back on the Republicans trying to hit him. Clip number two, Jacob.
We're opening up more than 75% of our potential oil resources offshore. We've quadrupled the number of operating rigs to a record high. We've added enough new oil and gas pipeline to encircle the earth and then some. We are drilling all over the place right now. That's not the challenge. That's not the problem.
See, there you go. So, I disagree with his decision to extend the existing Keystone XL pipeline from Missouri down to Texas. But I understand the incredible political power that the oil industry has. And the Republicans have just been beating this drum constantly. Why? Because they get their money from the oil industry. And gee whiz, what do you expect? So anyhow, we'll see. And then, of course, what's going on in Sanford, Florida? Democrats are once again trying to stop the influence of super PACs and the very wealthy. Legislation was introduced by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse yesterday to say that any super PAC that gets more than $10,000 has to disclose its donors anybody who gives more than $10,000 to a super PAC, their name has to be openly disclosed. Which might bring some interesting surprises. Is the Taliban giving to super PACs? We don't know. I'm serious. Is Al-Qaeda giving to super PACs? We don't know. Is David Duke giving to super PACs? We don't know. Everybody knows that Bill Maher gave to super PACs, but what about everybody else? We don't know. Anyhow, Alan in Seattle, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good. What's up?
Good. You know, it was a miracle, Tom, to turn on the radio. I work for the university. I work for Disability Resources.
Really, Alan, are you on a speakerphone? And if so, can you pick it up?
Sorry about that. I work for Disability Resources here in Seattle for disabled students, and I'm reading a book. And I just finished work. I got a meeting to go to. So I turn on the radio, and you're talking to a wonderful speaker. I don't know who the person
was. It's Joe Madison.
And what's his first name?
Joe Madison. JoeMadison.com. You can check it out.
You had a wonderful conversation that I was listening to. I only got the last part of it regarding privilege.
Yes.
And miraculously, I'm reading a book called Beyond Inclusion, Beyond Empowerment, A Developmental Strategy to Liberate Everyone by a woman named Letitia Nieto, N-I-E-T-O, and others, which clearly delineates privilege, not only white privilege, but all privilege, and denotes people in privilege as agent populations and people that are oppressed as a target population.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about things like power, status, rank, and rank roles. They have an acronym model called the dressing model, the agent and target roles, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But this is an amazing, amazing textbook delineating exactly what you're talking about when you express to people that we don't even know when we're in a privileged position.
Most men don't understand male privilege. Every woman understands that.
Everybody has privilege. Everybody has these dualities in their roles. I mean, that's the point of the book.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. Obviously, from a status standpoint, white males and so on down, I mean, have the highest level of privilege. But again, when they don't know it, discrimination against others is sometimes just an unconscious experience.
Sure.
Not that I'm justifying it, But this is a real, I mean, I would really suggest you even read this book. I think it would put things in perspective, and that's all I really needed to say. I was just so excited to be able to contribute this.
Okay,
because
sounds good.
Because it's such an empowering conversation.
Alan, thank you for sharing that with us, and thanks for listening to Talk Tonight. I appreciate it. Mark, you're listening to us on Sirius in Monterrey, Mexico. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing today? First of all, before I get to my point, I always like the Bernie Sanders stuff on Thursdays, I think
Thank
it
you.
Is.
On Fridays.
On Friday. I was flipping through, I saw a story that kind of caught my eye, and I get kind of bothered when I hear, like, Reverend Al Sharpton down there in Sanford and stuff like that, because I see Reverend Al as a racist, all right? There was two black kids that set a white kid on fire on March 4th in Kansas City, I do believe I read the article out of.
Yeah, you're going to, Mark is you know, if you're going to pull up some anecdotes of black people doing nasty things to white people, let me remind you about 400 years of slavery in this country, about 100 years of separate but equal. The fact of the matter is that it's very, you could, if racism is defined as using the difference between races to oppress people, then how can an African American be a racist? If you want to define it as disliking another race, I get that. But I think the genuine definition of racism, at least as it's acted out, is actually using the power that comes with privilege of being in the privileged race. And therefore, if you're in the oppressed race, it's damn hard to behave in a fashion that is, by that definition, racist. I'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And I think most African Americans understand that. I think that most white people don't. They think racism means somebody who doesn't like people of other races. It doesn't. That means racist.
But you gotta keep your head up, oh, and you can let your head down, hey. You gotta keep your head up, oh, and you can let your head down, hey. I know it's hard.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. This is really weird. Is it possible, Paul, listen to me for a minute. Paul, our call screener. I see a caller on line 5. It says, a white kid in Kansas burned by two black kids 2 months ago. That's what the last caller said. Are we getting a series of callers who've been listening to the right-wing channel? Three of them. Very interesting. who all have the same talking points. Okay, well, what can you say? Timothy in Palo Alto, California. Hey, Timothy, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, how are you doing, Robert? Hey,
Tom.
Forgive me.
That's okay.
Forgive me. How are you doing, Tom?
Fine.
I just wanted to call, and my one point is this. I just wanted to second what you had said about racism and about power, because the biggest thing to, I mean, the only way you can have true power, I mean, the only way you can show racism is by having power. Because, perfect example, if you have a bum on the street who hurls a racial epithet at a person walking down the street that is white, well, the person on the street has no effect. But right. That person who is walking down the street has the power to then say, hey, I saw someone like you on the street call me an epithet. I don't have to hire you.
Right.
And that's what this is all about. And people will always try and dilute it and say, oh, well, racism is just about, oh, you don't like someone because of their ethnicity. And it's not that. It is always about power. And I thank you for mentioning that, because it is the biggest debate that most people try and excuse what's been happening for the past couple hundred years.
Yeah. Try half a millennia, 500 years.
Half a millennia.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And in fact, I got an email here from some, you can always tell, well, I shouldn't, I was going to say, you can always tell when the white folks get upset. And I shouldn't say that because, I don't know, it might have been an African-American who sent me this email, but he says, Tom, you're wrong about your definition of racism. And then he pastes in a dictionary definition. And the dictionary definition, let me put my reading glasses on here, it's way over there. Racism, the belief that all members of each race possess characteristics or abilities specific to that race, especially as to distinguish it as inferior or superior to another race or races. Prejudice, discrimination, or antagonism directed against someone of a different race based on a belief, a program to combat racism, for example. And yeah, you know, so that's what the dictionary says. But the fact of the matter is that functionally in society, The way racism works is it keeps people down. The way racism works is it destroys people's lives. The way racism works is it lets people of one race kill, literally kill, people of another race and not have to answer for those crimes. And that has to do with power. And if you are the unpowered person, the disempowered person, the person who was not born with white privilege, and to a certain extent, this is, and, you know, talk to women, particularly women who are in the women's rights movement, this is the same thing. You know, women understand this about male privilege, right? That you know, women in America make 73 cents for every dollar that men make. African Americans in the United States make about 60 cents for every dollar white males make. It is the same thing. It's about power. As it has to do with race, a person with power can exercise racism in a way that's genuinely and truly destructive to other people, and a person of the oppressed race cannot, or in very rare circumstances could, but generally speaking cannot. And
very true. And let me mention this also with that. The majority right now, our country is at a precipice, at an edge where we're changing from being a majority white country of whites to a majority people of color, that black, Latino, Asian, all mixed together. So we're
in the next decade, we're going to hit that 50% point. Yeah,
exactly. If racism was supposedly something that everyone could, you know, that everyone was everyone could do, well, then we would have disparities amongst all people. But if you notice, the major disparities in this country are amongst mostly people of color, as in murder rates, as in health care, et cetera. That's major. And then two, and even incarceration rates. But this is the biggest thing I'd like to bring up for everyone. Look up the Baldus Report. And again, we've spoken about it with the Supreme Court. But look up the Baldus Report. They'll tell you. It's like racism is alive and well, and it's about ethnicity. It's not about and it's not about everyone having it. It's about a select few having it and exerting it on others.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well said. Timothy, thank you very much for calling. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Dan in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hello. Can you hear me?
I can. You're loud and clear.
Tom, I'd like to say that a lot of this has to do with the fact that we have the first African American president, and I think it's a domino effect because I think the white culture was not used to a bright, articulate man who can not only can he read a teleprompter, unlike our predecessor, you know, George Bush, but he's changed the what we're talking about as far
the dialogue
as race.
In America.
You remember when he gave the race speech
in Philadelphia? Yeah, I do.
Yeah, and he says that if we were to just condemn each other and retreat to our own respective corners, that it would only serve to widen the chasm.
Yes. Yes, absolutely, and he was right, and this has been his life. I mean, read his autobiography, and that's what. But frankly, I don't think that. Let me rephrase that. I agree with you for people probably over 40, maybe over 50, that some substantial, probably subset of white people of the generation that saw the first desegregation in the United States and the first backlash to that desegregation, to the forced busing in the 1950s and 60s and all of that, that generation, particularly the racist subset of it, is freaking out about the fact that we've got an African-American president. Thus, this incredibly popular bumper sticker in the South, don't re-NIG in 2012, right, with the Obama logo on it.
And I think a lot of people aren't talking about the big elephant in the room, and that is Fox News and the right-wing radio.
Yeah, let me add to that, though. I don't think that that's so much the case for people under 30 in the United States, for white people under 30. I think that there is a generation coming up that is far more colorblind than the generation that is...
Right, they know about diversity because they see it in their schools.
Yeah. By the way, the Sanford police chief just stepped aside. That's the big news report that's going on. So,
well, that's, you know, I think this is going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. But I'd like to say to everybody that's listening that we need to recognize that there are more African Americans that are being locked up than any other race. I mean, just look, and if you think that, you know, that slavery doesn't exist. It still does. I mean, just think of the fact that there is a, you know, that when you're in your car and you're driving down in the city, you look at a single black mom waiting for the bus, trying to get out to the suburbs to try to get a job.
Yeah, you know, or for that matter, consider the amount of stuff that's made by prison labor in the United States.
Exactly. And I live in a very poor city here. There's an area called the Fruit Belt, okay? Mm-hmm. And I used to drive a wheelchair van. And the streets are horrible. The homes are, I mean, it's almost like a third world country. Yeah. And I know a lot of the cities are similar. Yeah. You know, you go to Philadelphia.
This is the consequence of generation after generation of racism being acted out. Dan, thank you for the call. Thanks for your comments. Well said. Catherine in Long Beach, California. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hi, I'm shocked at the colors from the right wing that are going to turn this whole thing around.
Yeah.
This poor child.
No, I've got three calls on the board, or I had. They've dropped off since I called them out, who are waiting to come on and tell us about two black guys who torched a white kid or something close to that. That apparently everybody's talking about on the right-wing channels over on Sirius XM and on right-wing radio across America.
But, Tom, when did this country start to shoot to kill? When I was growing up, they shot an arm, a leg, but it was never shoot to kill.
Yeah.
We see homeless people being shot. What happened to us?
Well, in this...
61-year-old white woman, and I want the family to know that we're all in this together.
Yep.
This is America.
Yep.
This could happen to your child or my child.
This modern-day law, this shoot-to-kill law that Jeb Bush so enthusiastically signed into law in 2006 in Florida, was apparently originally authored by the NRA or was requested. There's this thing called the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, which is funded by the Koch brothers. And twice a year they have these retreats where they bring together one-to-one 50% corporate lobbyists, 50% mostly Republican state legislators. And they vote on these corporate lobbyists, put forward laws, and then they have an equal vote with the elected officials on whether these laws will be ALEC approved, and if they are, then the Republicans take them back to their state and introduce them as legislation. In 2005, the NRA, you know, one of the lobbying groups that's represented at ALEC, apparently, brought forward this, requested this legislation, this so-called castle law or whatever, stand your ground law, shoot first to kill law, whatever you want to call it. And ALEC approved it in 2005, and now it's popped up in 16 states, I believe, maybe 20, one or the other, and been approved. And it's great for the NRA. It's like, you know, increasing the number of people who have weapons and making them feel like, hey, you know, this is the Wild West. I can shoot anybody I want, you know, and just like Matt Dillon, I won't go to jail for it. And it has resulted in the state of Florida. Since that law was passed, justifiable homicides, in quotes, have tripled. Thank you, Catherine.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's amazing. I mean, this is something in Sanford, Florida, the chief of police stepping aside. We'll see how this plays out as we continue. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Lowell in St. Louis. No, I'm sorry. Marie in El Jebel, Colorado. Hey, Marie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. A real quick definition that I learned when I was in seminary. I am a racist if I benefit by the oppression of another.
Wow,
and that's an important thing to do so that I don't get on my high horse and go, well, I'm not a racist. These guys over here are.
Right.
But I benefit
right.
when other people are put down. And that's an important thing to remember.
It's true.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I've spent the entire week working with a group of middle school kids who are writing a grant proposal to put into place this wonderful program called Kids for Compassion that they're inventing to eliminate intolerance and bullying in the middle school. You know, you were saying a minute ago that the kids get it, and that's exactly what I'm finding. They get it. I'm so disappointed in my baby boomer generation. It's like we had a glimmer at one point, and then we lost it.
Well, Louise, my wife, went to East Lansing High School, which is, you know, East Lansing was pretty upscale community. It is mostly the families of professors at Michigan State University, and it's not a rich town, not like Beverly Hills, but you know, compared to the kind of blue collar where I grew up in South Lansing, and she took classes. We didn't get them where I was going to school about the same time. She's 2 years younger than me, but you know, it's pretty much the same time. She actually had to take classes in high school on the African American experience. This was an all white school.
Cool. And
so I think that there were some efforts being made back in the 60s, but, you know, it wasn't all that substantial, and it kind of faded away, particularly with the Reagan presidency.
We sold our souls.
Well, Reagan's first speech when he was running for president, Louise says they were black awareness classes. Pardon my mistaking the phrase. And Reagan's first speech when he was running for president was down in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where three civil rights workers were slain, and he was talking about states' rights. I mean, he just, you know, ever since Reagan became president, this curtain came down, and we kind of froze time for 30 years, and we haven't had this national conversation. Marie, thank you very much for the call. I hope that this Trayvon Martin situation will provoke, and I think it is, a national conversation about these issues. Lowell in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Lowell, what's up?
Oh, how you doing, Tom? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I agree with everything you're saying about the Trayvon issue, and I think it's going to provoke a lot of interesting conversation, and it's a long time coming. But what I hope doesn't happen is it doesn't put a bad light on everyone that does have a conceal and carry, and it doesn't put a bad light on the people that are in neighborhood watch groups. I'm in a neighborhood watch group,
sure,
and I have a conceal and carry permit, but I would never, ever chase a kid down to shoot him. There's
well, to the best of my knowledge, Lowell, nobody on this show has ever called in and suggested that this is a gun control issue or a concealed and carry issue or a neighborhood watch issue, and I have never suggested that.
Well,
this
looks to me like it's an
issue of what happens in a gated, largely white community when a young man is guilty of the crime of walking while black.
I know, it's terrible. It's first degree murder. That's all it is.
It is, you know? or at the very least, second degree murder. Absolutely, I'm totally with you.
Yeah.
Lowell, thank you very much. Keith in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Keith, what's up? Keith, you are on the air. Keith is not on the air. Okay, Ron in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Ron, what's up?
I think you might mean Ann.
Oh, Ann, I'm sorry. You're right. I do.
That's all right. I'm an African-American woman. I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in my 60s. I have two terminal degrees. Why two doctorate degrees? Because I have to be twice as good to get a job.
Yeah, that was the point that Joe Madison made about a half
hour
ago.
All right. So about 10 callers back, you had someone who mentioned a book. I wanted that title, but that's not why I called.
I'm sorry, I didn't write it down. I usually do, but I didn't.
Is your program going to be repeated?
Yeah, it's every 3 hours for the next 24, yes.
Okay, I might get it then. My major concern is...
Well, it'll be in our newsletter, actually. If you subscribe to our newsletter, you'll have a link to the book. Sue caught it. It's in the chat room. It'll be in our newsletter tonight, the title of that book, which is why I didn't write it down.
My major reason for calling is to say, back up off of this situation, the people who were saying, well, it wasn't the police, it was an armed citizen. It is a police mentality in this country, and it has been for 400 years. If you're black, you're under suspicion. And in modern times, if you have a hood, you're under suspicion.
Yep.
Majorly, what are you doing here? So before the next 24 hours, some person in some all-white wealthy neighborhood may call the police and say, there's a strange black man in the neighborhood.
Right. In fact, odds are it'll happen a dozen times in the next 24 hours.
A dozen times in the next 24 hours. So every city has this police mentality.
Mm.
He's black. He's strange. He doesn't belong here. And you're absolutely right about institutional racism. It has to have power. I want to refer you to Dr. Peggy McIntosh's article, very short, quick read. It's a list of white privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Was published 20 years ago. You can find it on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
She was banned in three. She's a little white Scottish lady, and she was banned in three states for mm-hmm. publishing this article. It's been taught in a lot of major colleges, and it's sort of died out now.
We have a little less than a minute to the end of this hour, Anne. What's the summary of it?
The summary is that it's a racist mentality that blacks have their place,
mm.
and they're not where I work, they're not where I live,
mm.
they're not in my neighborhood, and I can do something about it. I can exercise power,
right.
even to death, to remove them. That's my point.
Yeah, and very well said. And this is not just limited to race. This is also, look at all the men only clubs that used to exist. This applies to gender as well. Yeah, although at the moment it's not as serious. But up until the 1920s in the United States, if a married woman, if her husband died, another male had to be appointed to divide her estate. And up until the late 1890s, that male could control her estate and decide who got her kids. Anne, thank you very much for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, there are other things happening in the world. There's a whole variety of them. One of them is that Tennessee this week passed legislation that requires teachers, not colleges, high schools, middle schools, and elementary schools to teach their children that there is a controversy about whether the world is 5,000 years old or 6,000 years old or 5 billion years old. And that there's a controversy about whether humans are causing global warming or not. The controversies, yes. And John G. West, Ph.D. of the Discovery Institute, the senior fellow and associate director of the Discovery Institute, is on the line with us. The website, of course, is Discovery. No, I'm sorry. Yes, it is. It's discovery.org, isn't it?
Yep, it is.
Okay. Dr. West, welcome to the program. This Gillian Flockus has written this piece out of Los Angeles about a fellow who was fired, apparently. Well, according to the Jet Propulsion Laboratories, he was one of 246 JPL employees who were let go due to planned budget cuts. In other words, he was the victim of the Republican austerity programs. But he's claiming, and he had gotten two warnings before from coworkers complaining about harassment, and he's saying that harassment was his trying to talk his fellow workers, his fellow scientists, into believing his creation point of view, his creationist point of view, and therefore he was selected to be among those laid off or fired, and this is some kind of religious discrimination. Do I have that right?
That's what he's claiming, yes, because the Jet Propulsion Lab perceived his views as religious. He doesn't accept the idea that his support of intelligent design is religious, but they perceived it as that, and so under the law, if that's why they're treating him in a certain way, then religious discrimination would be prohibited.
Do you know of any Buddhists who believe in intelligent design?
Actually, I got correspondence once from a Buddhist in Canada, a scholar who was very favorable towards intelligent design. So I think that there may be some.
I don't see a big movement in the Buddhist world. You know, China, Tibet, Vietnam, Thailand. My point is that this intelligence design is based basically in the Book of Genesis, and if something is based in a religious book, how can you say it's not religious?
Well, actually, intelligence design isn't based on the Book of Genesis. It's based on things like the fine tuning of the universe, where there are all these dozens of parameters. If they're even the slightest bit different, life as we know it wouldn't exist at all.
Right.
And that's well recognized by scientists, and so there are even people.
John,
say,
that's mixing up cause and effect. You and I are the descendants of people who successfully had children. That doesn't mean that nobody ever existed who didn't have children.
No, but the alternate explanation to design is basically chance and necessity. And
well, that's what I was just saying. So, there was chance and necessity in the human race, and over time it led to you and me being alive and the children of people who never had children not existing.
But no matter how many billions of years you have, and I accept that there's many billions of years, probabilistically, the thing that you're talking about, it's like one chance in almost infinitesimal amounts that things would turn out the way they have. So
right, and what
are, so that we have life, and so I think it's a valid, you know, it's a valid debate. But
well, take this back to people. I mean, what are the odds that a person 160,000 years ago living in the savannas of Southwest Africa would end up being the great 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 a whole bunch of greats grandparent of you and me? The odds are pretty slim, aren't they? But it happened. That doesn't mean that God made it happen.
Well, intelligent design doesn't say that through science you can know whether it was God who planned it or not. But getting back to the case of David Coppedge, which you raised, just right. To clarify a few things, what he was accused of doing was actually once or twice a month offering his colleagues a couple of videos about intelligent design, and if they didn't want it, fine. If they did, he loaned it to them. No one ever complained about that. What happened in 2009 was a supervisor heard about it and got upset and chewed him out. He didn't have two warnings. Mm-hmm. He had no warnings, and in fact, no one actually complained to him. The first he heard about it was in the beginning of 2009, and then he was ordered to stop, which he did. But
the other 246 Jet Propulsion Laboratories scientists who were laid off at the same time he was, the other 245, they weren't passing out religious literature.
Two. Actually, that's a deceptive figure because, in fact, in his class, it was actually two people who were laid off. They aggregated a lot of other people.
Was the other one passing out Jehovah's Witness literature or some other stuff that could be interpreted as religious?
No, but in fact, what happened at what David Coppedge raised the objection or question is the Jet Propulsion Lab had a policy. They allowed people to bash intelligent design, to put up political cartoons, bashing various people's views. This was people were allowed to talk about all sorts of views.
People had free speech. Isn't there a difference?
So the point is not whether he should have special rights or whether he should have the right to proselytize or you know harass people. The question is, should he have the right to talk about his views in precisely the same way that all of his colleagues were allowed to? And even if he didn't have the right, should they basically be able to reprimand, demote, and then ultimately get rid of him? When the first time it was raised with him, there's no question he stopped doing it. Even if they didn't have the right to say,
what state was this happening in?
Excuse me?
What state?
California.
So I don't know if California is or is not a right to work for less state. I think it is. And I don't know if Jet Propulsion Laboratories is unionized or not. No idea. But I'm guessing that because a union representative is not yelling about this, it is not. So, you know, basically in the workplace in America, unless you have a union and you are not in a right to work for less state, and you are in a free bargaining state, unless you have a union defending you, you have no free speech rights in the workplace. The workplace, you know, the First Amendment protects us against oppression by our government, not by our employers.
But the issue here is actually you do have a right to be free from discrimination. So see, the issue here, yes, could Jet Propulsion Lab, taxpayer funded, it's quasi private, quasi public, it's wholly funded by our tax dollars. So it's almost a government agency, even though technically it's not. But could they have said, no employee speech on things outside the workplace, pro or con, nothing dealing with politics.
But
yes, they could have done that.
But to demonstrate religious, you know, prejudice, you pretty much have to demonstrate that you're a member of a persecuted religious minority. I don't think that somebody who's aggressively proselytizing for the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster is going to be taken seriously.
Okay.
And I don't think in a scientific environment that somebody proselytizing for intelligent design is going to be taken seriously.
He wasn't proselytizing. He was asking his colleagues if they wanted to watch a video, and when they said no, he said fine. And if they did, he loaned it to them. But again, the point is you cannot, and you as a progressive, I would think, would understand this in basic discrimination law. What you can't do is choose one person out of, a thousand employees or however many employees they say, and we're going to apply different standards to you. And
but this wasn't his religion.
You talk about whatever they want.
You're asserting on the one hand that this is not a religious belief, and now you, and then at the same time you're saying that he was discriminated against because of his religion. That makes no sense.
The law is clear. They said Jet Propulsion Lab said we think that's a religious belief, and then
they said that he was one of 246 employees let go because of budget cuts that were promoted by the Republican Party.
That happened actually 2 years after the initial demotion and reprimand, and so they're saying it was unrelated. We know from the email traffic that at the time of the initial demotion and reprimand, they were talking behind the scenes of how do we get rid of him because of the things that he was doing that they didn't like.
Well, if I had an employee who was constantly coming to me about the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster and how we have to have more pirates to stop global warming,
I think you as a liberal would support people who have views that you disagree with.
I generally do. I'm talking about what the law is here, and
the law says you can't make an arbitrary decision based on someone's religion.
People can read about it at discovery.org. John West, thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more on this and the Trayvon Martin situation and President Obama with his pipeline. There's so much in the news today. Stick around.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school.
Welcome back and proud to my favorite segment of the week when we have just 2-3 minutes here to talk about science, one of my favorite topics. This was in the New York Times. Yudhitaj Bhattarachi, I'm sure I'm mangling his or her name. But anyhow, the writing in the New York Times, the headline, Why Bilinguals Are Smarter. And, they used to be the conventional wisdom for centuries was that raising a child speaking more than one language actually inhibited their mental development. And that's one of the reasons why in the United States there has never been a strong bilingual movement. In fact, most Americans are monolingual. They speak one language and that's English. Whereas in Holland, for example, you have to speak 4 languages to get out of high school. In Germany, you have to speak 3. Or at least it was back in the 80s when we lived there and our kids were in the public school system. And most European countries, you have to speak at least 2 or 3 languages to get out of high school. And they start teaching them in elementary school. So what's the actual science? What does it actually demonstrate? Well, it turns out being bilingual makes you smarter. It has a profound, I'm quoting here from this piece in the New York Times, the Sunday Times, it has a profound effect on your brain, improves cognitive skills not related to language, and even shields against dementia in old age. In fact, what they found was that Alzheimer's disease, the higher the degree of bilingualism, the later the age of onset. The bilingual experience, again quoting from the New York Times, the bilingual experience improves the brain's so-called executive function. Executive function is things like the ability to ignore distractions, the ability to focus your attention on intentionally on one thing and keep it there, and filter out the environment, the ability to successfully remember a sequence of events, like directions when you're driving, that kind of thing, that people who are bilingual are better at all of these things, and they're better at puzzles. They're better at most tests of mental acuity. We need to be teaching kids second languages at the age of 5. It should start in kindergarten. And it'll make all of us a whole lot smarter. Let's see here. Xiolan, am I pronouncing that right? X-E-O-L-A-N in Chicago, listening to WCPT?
It was misspelled, I think. It's Zellen.
Zellen.
Talked before.
Okay.
Yeah, it's wonderful to talk to you again, Tom.
Thanks for calling. What's up?
Well, I'm a Buddhist, and I was going to help clarify what we think about the nature of reality and its, inception, if there was any. I was just going to say that we believe that there's no such thing as nothing. And to that end, creation, destruction, these things cannot happen in such a way that eliminates reality. So we believe in beginningless time, and we believe in time without end.
Okay. So does that make you a creationist, a person who believes that the world is 6,000 years old? Or a person who believes that the world is 6 billion years old or the universe is 15 billion years old, but it only got here because an intelligent designer fine-tuned zillions and zillions of things every second all along the way and still is.
Well, they said of Hinduism, which Buddhism is slightly built on, the way that they perceive reality as existing is divided into what you could refer to as the field and the field knower,
right,
which is basically matter and consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't believe, we believe is a weird word for us. We know that gods exist, but none of them created anything. None of them created the universe that we live in.
So what's a god?
We believe in causality, mm-hmm, and we believe in reality. Causality would be karma, and reality would be dharma.
I see. Okay, yes. Words
and we believe in infinite causality, and for the reason that we don't believe that there's anything that could be nothing, so there can't be anything that came before,
right,
everything else.
Okay, you've done a great job of describing your belief system. The point of my conversation with a fellow before from the Discovery Institute was just like you are prefacing everything with the "we believe," his guy was prefacing things with "we believe." He was a scientist working in a scientific community, and scientists typically don't start out saying "we believe." They say, "We have a hypothesis and we're going to test it. And it may or may not stand up, even if we think that it will." And which raises the question for me, should a creationist even become a scientist? Is it possible to be a scientist if you're a creationist? Particularly in the same field, right? Is that even possible? I mean, this guy was in a field that involved cosmology. You know, I get it that, you know, Carl Sagan, when he looked through the eyepiece of the telescope at the universe, just was blown away and had what some people would describe as a religious experience, although he didn't, at least according to his wife when we interviewed her on this program last year. And that's a different thing than saying, "I believe that there is an intelligent hand guiding all this stuff."
Well, it's hard to talk about belief, and I'm sorry that I'm using that term. It's the way that I can convey it, and we're habituated to that term. Buddhism is science. It's science of the mind. It's primarily psychology.
Well, to the extent that it can be demonstrated. I mean, I don't think of psychology as a science. I think of it as part science, mostly art.
Okay. Well, I invite you to have Robert Thurman on your show in order to better articulate this, and I'm sorry that I'm not able to, but no, as far as a creationist, also being a scientist, I guess that would be a hard or untenable position for many. But as far as Buddhists are concerned, we consider ourselves to have a scientific perspective.
Yeah. Well, where I was going with that, in that debate with him, was because the creationists seem to be exclusively fundamentalist Christians, this is clearly some sort of a religious perspective, and does that have a place in the workplace? And frankly, you know, I think probably not. But anyway, thanks very much for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, as an employer, I don't mind if any of my employees are religious, atheist, whatever. But if they're spending a lot of time trying to convert people in the workplace, that's a distraction.
Hey, I put some new shoes on and suddenly everything's right. I said, hey, I put some new shoes on and everybody's smiling. It's so inviting. No, short on money, but long on time. Slowly showing in the sweet sunshine.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Media, occupying the media here on the Tom Hartman Program. Just made Jacob's day. He invented that phrase for us. Art in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hey, Art, what's up?
Yeah, did you hear about the CNN is running a story about the same incident that happened about a year ago? This Trevor Dooley. Have you heard about that, Tom?
I have not.
Well, he shot, it was, all this tragedy was over a skateboard. Some kid in the neighborhood was riding a skateboard, and Dooley, the shooter, was telling the kid to stop.
Oh, you're talking about the case up in Wisconsin?
No, this is in Florida.
In Florida? Oh, okay. There's another one.
He's standing by the same stand your ground, all this shooter.
Right.
What happened? David James was in the park across the street playing with his daughter,
mm-hmm.
and he defended the skateboarder who was skating board, and then him and Trevor Dooley got into a fight because Trevor had pulled his gun out.
Right.
And then he started to walk back home, and then James attacked him with his hands, and then the shooter pulled his gun out and shot David with a little girl standing there in the chest, in his heart, and he was dead.
Right. So this is a white guy who was shot,
by
an African-American guy. Okay.
Now, the CNN is running right now, and this happened about a year ago, Tom, so I'm thinking they're bringing this out so maybe they can, if they can show CNN that a black guy shot this white guy, maybe this will calm people's...
They're trying to create a false equivalence.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in this case, the shooter was actually physically assaulted by the guy he shot.
Right.
And that's very much not the case with Trayvon Martin.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. Why is CNN running this story? You know,
well, because they're trying to, you know, this narrative of false equivalence is what right wingers always do when they, you know, when they say it's just like this Kansas City thing. I've got a couple of emails here. I got one from Chris. It says this Kansas City story that apparently the right wing radio is all over today about a white kid who was burned by a couple of African American kids.
CNN's not right wing, are they?
Well,
I thought they were kind of neutral.
You know. Let me ask you a question, just in the abstract. The Progressive Caucus, Jan Schakowsky and almost 100 other members of Congress have come up with a budget that would balance the U.S. budget within 10 years, within a decade,
mm-hmm.
would strengthen Social Security and Medicare, would improve the social safety net, would allow kids to go to college for damn near free, would raise taxes on millionaires and billionaires to pay for all this stuff, and would work. And in fact, it would not even take our tax rate back to being as high as it was during the Republican Eisenhower administration. Okay? They proposed that on the one hand. And on the other hand, you had Paul Ryan, who's proposed a budget that cuts Social Security, cuts Medicare, cuts food stamps, cuts services, cuts Pell Grants, you know, college grants for middle class and poor kids, cuts basically everything, deregulates a whole bunch of different industries so they can pollute more, keeps intact the subsidies for the oil industry, and gives a $3 trillion tax cut to the billionaires and trillionaires, or millionaires and billionaires, excuse me.
Right.
Which one of those two budgets, neither one of them are going to pass the House. But the progressive budget has almost 90 votes behind it. Paul Ryan's budget hasn't even got out of his own committee. So far, his committee of 8 or 10 people, he's got a couple of Republicans who are already saying, no, we're not going to vote for this. So his bill, his budget has absolutely no chance. The progressive budget actually could get a vote, and certainly in the Senate would get a vote. Which one of those got the most news coverage?
Yeah. The Warren Buffett rule, right? That's what President Obama's pushing.
No, this has got nothing to do with the Warren Buffett rule. The one that got all the news coverage... The one that got all the news coverage was the Paul Ryan bill.
Paul Ryan's,
you know,
right.
he's been all over the media like crazy. So you say, is CNN right wing? I say yes.
Yeah,
if the right wingers come up with something, if the right wingers are pushing an agenda, if Matt Drudge is all over it, if Joe Scarborough is all over it, CNN is all over it too. The idea that the media in this country is liberal is nonsense. The media in this country is corporate, and the corporate power structure is also the white power structure.
Tom, how old are you?
I'm 60.
Okay, I'm 62. I just started getting my Social Security, and this stuff scares me. If Paul Ryan, I'm hoping they don't get through, but if they get a president in the White House that's a Republican, let's say it be whoever, Gingrich or whoever, I'm going to lose my Social Security.
Yeah,
it's
a good reason to get active in the Democratic Party. All right, I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening to us in Cincinnati. Ted in Spokane, Washington, listening in KAEP. Hey, Ted, what's up? 1280 AM.
Hey, Tom. Huge fan over here on the conservative side of Washington State.
Yeah. Well, thanks for listening. What's up?
Hey, I was just calling about, you know, the whole Florida deal. You know, Florida's going to become very, very important here in a couple of months.
Yep.
And
swing state.
Exactly. So, you know, the calls you got about, you know, some kid getting burned by two black kids or whatever.
Yep.
You know, they're getting organized.
Yep.
You're going to see.
They're coming up with their counter narrative, their false equivalency.
Exactly. Exactly. And you should see it on the Internet, too. It's the same thing, too. It almost looks like an organized anything that's got Obama on it. You know, a lot of the, you know, the messages from, you know, comments or whatever, you know, a lot of times it doesn't even have anything to do with what the story was about. You know, it's a well organized, you know, plan. And Florida, you know, I don't want to broad brush Floridians. You know, my bass player is from Satellite Beach, and
there's a lot of good people in Florida.
Crazy things happen there.
There's a lot of good people everywhere. You know, there are no red or blue states. We're all variations of purple. I mean, a radically right-wing state might go 51% Republican, 45% Democratic, and a radically blue state, you know, New York, California, might go 55% Democratic, 45% Republican. But we're, you know, all right across the board. We're all in this together. And you're right, Ted. Florida's a swing state. And by the way, the police chief just stepped down, quote, temporarily, end quote. So the plot thickens. Ted, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Joey in Springfield, Missouri. Hey, Joey, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just want to say that, you know, to say I think is the same thing as saying I digest my food or I beat my heart. Thinking happens.
Right.
And what this racism involves is, like, if you stand and you look at yourself in a mirror, you see yourself aging and everything else. But if you look away and just become aware of your surroundings, that presence that's there has no height, no skin color, no color of eyes, no anything that divides it. It just is.
Yeah.
That's your being. And what's causing the racism and all this other stuff is our identification with our mind, with our thoughts, instead of awareness of just our being, because
and
that's
our
what
identification,
we all have in common.
And our identification with our body and our community and our tribe, as it were, you know, the family that we came from, the neighborhood we came from, the state.
You don't have
from.
Any of that. Your inner body is not even there. When you're just aware, you just are. You're not aware of a body or anything. You have to look at that and go through all that. But in your awareness, you just are.
Yeah.
There's nothing there. And awareness is awakening. And I think that's what people are coming to. They're starting to look beyond their thinking.
Yeah.
And it's this thinking, you know, identification with the mind that has to stop.
Yeah.
You know,
I totally agree with you. Thank you, Joey, for the call. And for the dialectic. Alex in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Alex, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You're leaving me hanging this week. Have you said anything about the Alexandra Pelosi Bill Maher video, the documentary?
No, I don't know about it.
You got to watch it. See, you're a master teacher. I've learned a lot from you. But I'm entering the stage of my political evolution where I'm tired of being right and I want to win.
Being effective is fun.
What's that?
Being effective is fun, yeah.
Yeah, and I think we as liberals, we're so concentrated on being right that we forget focus of winning.
Yeah.
And one of the things that this controversial documentary, you know, it's where she juxtaposed the welfare recipients, white working class folks in Mississippi with the welfare recipients that are 99% African American on the video in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And she shows how people are working against the white voters are voting against their own interest,
right,
and vice versa.
Right.
And it talks about the
So where Alex, where can I find this documentary? Is this playing on HBO or is it on the web?
You can go to YouTube and you can just put in Alexandra Pelosi Bill Maher documentary, some
great
of those words, all of this, like, but you got to talk about it because I think that you and I'll be, as long as I'm listening to your show in the future, 5 years, 10 years from now, we'll be hearing about these tragedies in Florida until we do one thing, and that is we get the white, working, and middle-class voter to vote Democrat again.
Well,
we're not going
to
win.
Right, to vote their own self-interest. This is what Thomas Frank wrote a whole book about, you know, what's the matter with Kansas. You nailed it. Alex, thanks a lot for the call. Just a minute left before the hour. Baltimore in El Cerezo, Texas. Do I have that right? Maybe not. No, I'm sorry. It's Rick in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Rick. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I love your show, man. I watch it religiously, and I hate to use that term.
Thank you.
But I'd like to say something about this Trayvon Martin thing.
Uh-huh.
We're bringing racism into it. We're bringing all kinds of gun control laws into it. We're bringing a law that is probably poorly written into it. But the point that I'd like to kind of keep on point with is this is a decision that needs to be made by the Federal Attorney General's office and a jury of 12. And what the real protest in my mind is that we are being denied due process.
Well, and Trayvon Martin has been denied due process. I mean, they didn't even interrogate, seriously interrogate or drug test or alcohol test the man who murdered him, but they did drug and alcohol test his dead body. I mean, tell me there's not something strange about that. But you're right, Rick, and this will be played out in the courts. But I would also say that, you know, the American Legislative Exchange Council bringing forward this legislation is problematic.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check in with the Talk Radio News Service next. And is my concern about Reagan a religion in and of itself? I don't know. Could be. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes, 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, the former congressman. Bob, your ears must have been burning a couple of days ago because I was talking about you.
Okay, that's good. I'm used to it.
I was speaking well of you. I have a lot of respect for you. You were the story I was telling was when you were a Republican congressman from Ohio. You were the only member of Congress, the United States Congress, who speaks Farsi, mm-hmm. which is the language that they speak in Iran. And that the Iranians, this was during the George Bush, W. Bush administration, the Iranians reached out to you through the Swiss embassy, if my recollection is correct, mm-hmm. in Farsi, and basically said, we would like to have a rapprochement with the United States. You took that message to the Bush administration, and they basically said, get the hell out of here. Did I characterize that accurately?
You got it correctly. Absolutely. Tim Guliman was ambassador from Switzerland to Tehran. He came to my office. He handed me a document that in 2003 that I said, wow. It gave us inspectors on the ground, American citizens on the ground, to look for nuke activity in Iran, which is what we want. It had a backdoor recognition of Israel, and it agreed for the Iranians to disband Hezbollah as a terrorist faction. And they wanted two things, respect, and they wanted the lifting of sanctions eventually. And it was an amazing document. I sent it to Karl Rove. He called me. He said, is this real? I said, yes, it is. Then they later denied that they received it. Condoleezza denied she knew it, Condoleezza Rice. Colin Powell's former chief of staff is the one who said, yes, this document came around.
Is that Larry Wilkerson?
Yeah. Now, there's been all these rumors that, you know, I was asking Colin Powell for airplane parts. I never had that conversation with him.
Yeah.
We have been backdoor channels, me and Vic Snyder, a Democrat congressman from Arkansas, former congressman, backdoor channels for Clinton. We were backdoor channels in the Bush administration when they had delicate issues with Iran and our soldiers and the Iraq war, et cetera. It's mm-hmm. not uncommon. It's an open secret.
Sure.
However, this one was a direct outreach that could have avoided what we're in. Dick Cheney didn't want it. Pure and simple. They sabotaged it, Rumsfeld, and it all just died. Now, Tony Snow, God rest his soul, when asked, did Bob Ney send this to Karl Rove, he said, look where he's at. I was in prison at the time.
Right.
Doesn't give you credibility.
Right. In fact, I find it, I don't know your thoughts on this, but I find it not just a coincidence that after you did this, you were the only guy who in Congress who went to jail for the whole Abramoff scandal, when people like Ralph Reed, in my opinion, from what I know of this, did a whole lot worse than you did.
It didn't help who
yeah.
I was angering.
Yeah.
Not, my own idiocy, don't get me wrong, but it also didn't help.
Yeah.
This was a wonderful document, Tom, and I allowed Dr. Trita Parsi, and he's got a book on the treacherous alliances, the secret deals of Israel, Iran, and America.
Right.
And before, the day I went into prison, I said, go ahead and talk about it, Trita. Put it in your book. Let it get out there.
Great, great. So, but George Bush could not allow a rapprochement with Iran, and Iran could not allow Iran to recognize Israel's right to exist and all those other things that you just listed, because he just declared them part of the axis of evil. He had to have an enemy.
That's right, and he did it at a time when, you know, there was outreach. I'm not saying I like the Iranian rulers. I'm not saying the mullahs are good by any stretch of imagination. But at that time, a direct roadmap was offered into the lap of the White House. And the reason they picked me is because I was Republican. I knew Karl Rove. What a great way for it to go over there versus coming through somebody else.
Right.
And
right.
That's what they wanted. They wanted it to directly get into Karl Rove's hands. It did. Then he denies that it ever happened.
That's incredible. Bob, thank you for setting the record straight. Now, in the minute and a half we have left, what's going on in the world?
Well, we've got insider trading. The Senate passes the insider trading bill, which would have put anyone in jail a lot longer than I was if you did insider trading, except for the members of the Congress. So that's, I think, a good cleanup measure had to happen. Paul Ryan introduced his budget, and, of course, he's upping some defense money, but he's going to get, you know, hit brutally about where he's trying to take off discretionary money and also Medicare. You know,
I'm curious, why is it that, you know, Jan Schakowsky and other members of the Progressive Caucus put forward a very, very solid budget that would balance the budget in a decade or so and that strengthens the social safety net and raises taxes on billionaires and multimillionaires, and it got no publicity at all. Paul Ryan, but it easily would have gotten 80 or 90 votes. I mean, there's that many members of the caucus. Paul Ryan puts forward a budget that he can't even get out of his own committee, and he's on TV with Joe Scarborough practically having sex on TV. I mean, they're kissing each other so much on this thing. It's, you know, why does the right-wing stuff get all this publicity and the progressive stuff gets ignored?
When we had the first balanced provisions for funding caucuses and committees with Steny Hoyer and I, they wouldn't give it any ink. I approached a reporter and he said, "Congressman Ney, we don't report when the planes land." And that's what's happened here. Schakowsky could have been a something. I think that was a great working, you know, blueprint.
Yeah.
And they would have been hard. It would have been hard for the Republicans to say, "Well, we don't want to look at that at all." But I just think the ink, you know, came in the direction of controversy and with Ryan, and that served a better purpose, I guess, than practical substance.
Well, and it seems like this narrative of Social Security and Medicare being in trouble, and Medicare wouldn't be in trouble if they could negotiate drug prices. That poison pill was put in there by the Republicans. Social Security would not be in trouble. In fact, it would be totally solvent if we simply lifted the cap and let Bill Gates pay the same amount of Social Security that you and I pay. But those things don't get discussed. It's like the narrative of crisis is the only narrative that the corporate media wants.
It's the same thing over and over. It's sad. There are some good changes that can be made, but that's what's sexy, I guess, spicy, and that's what's an agenda-driven item, too, by some of the media.
Well, and this, you know, similarly, the fact that in 2003 Iran approached you and said they want to have peace with the United States, nobody hears about that, but nobody hears, by the way, that a week and a half ago Ahmadinejad was dressed down by the mullahs, you know, threatened by the mullahs for his bellicose rhetoric. They told him to tone it down. That got no press in the United States. It was all over the world. It was covered, but not in the United States.
The White House reprimanded the ambassador for bringing it to me. That got press.
Yeah, there you go. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, among other things. Bob, you're a good man, and it's a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for dropping by today. We will be right back here on the Tom Hartman program. Actually, we've got John Nichols coming up, the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, about Wisconsin's very own Trayvon Martin case.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the Trayvon Martin case is capturing the headlines. George Zimmerman has not been captured, to the best of my knowledge. The police chief of Sanford, Florida, is temporarily on leave. This isn't the first of these sorts of things to have happened in the world. John Nichols, the Washington reporter for TheNation.com, Nation Magazine, on the line with us from Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, John, welcome.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you back. Tell us about what's going on in Wisconsin. You've got your very own Trayvon Martin up there?
Well, I think that we have to be careful. All these cases are different.
Sure.
But they reference back to the passage of copycat bills across this country. The Florida law is not unique to one state. It's part of a pattern of laws put in place across this country at the behest of the National Rifle Association and via the American Legislative Exchange Council.
ALEC,
so we have
the Koch brothers
corporate-funded group that basically develops model legislation. So these laws have been put on the books all over the country. What's striking and important is that we're now starting to see patterns coming off these laws. In Florida, we've heard a report coming out of their Department of Justice that shows that they've had a more than 200% increase in the number of so-called justifiable homicides since the passage of their law. In Wisconsin, we just passed a law very, very recently under the current legislature signed by Governor Walker. And just about 2 weeks ago, there was a terrible incident in a town called Slinger, Wisconsin, where a young African-American youth named Bo Morrison, I guess I shouldn't call him youth, he was 20 years old, and he was at a drinking party with a bunch of friends, multiracial, all sorts of folks who had grown up in the area, and the party got broken up because they thought the cops were coming, and all the kids ran and hid in different places. This kid, Bo Morrison, hid on the front porch of a neighboring house. He walked in an open door and hid on the porch.
Mm-hmm.
The homeowner heard some kind of noise out front, came out with a gun, and shot Bo Morrison, shot him dead. And there is no evidence that this kid had a gun, that he made any sort of wild or violent move. He did not break into the house. He was not in the house. He was on a porch. Now, that's not to justify what was going on that night. It was, you know, kids partying.
Mm-hmm.
But you've ended up with a horrible situation, and this young man is dead. And yesterday, the county prosecutor in that county decided not to press any charges and cited Wisconsin's new Castle Doctrine or Stand Your Ground law.
Or shoot first, or, you know, kill him as fast as you can, or whatever you want to call
him. Tom, I think it's best summed up by Kendall Coffey, the longtime federal prosecutor down in Florida, who is a real tough-on-crime guy, hardly somebody who is casual about these things. And he says, this is a license to kill law.
Right.
It says that you can kill someone, and no matter what the circumstances, you're probably going to get away with it.
John, here's something that's been nagging at me. The American Legislative Exchange Council, you know, 20, 30 years ago, brought into being with largely money from the Koch brothers, if my understanding is correct.
You're exactly right.
Okay. This is a what has been a very, very shadowy group, and in fact has even gotten shadowier because they no longer post their model legislation on their website, and they a Wisconsin Democratic state representative, we had him on our show several times now, paid his $100 and showed up, and when they discovered he was a Democrat, they threw him out. And so it's mostly Republicans. There's a few hardcore right-wing blue dog or yellow dog or whatever, no dog at all, Democrats who show up. But it's mostly Republican legislators and lobbyists, 50-50, side by side. The lobbyists pay up to $100,000 to sit there. The legislators pay $100 and very often get all their expenses paid to show up there. And they write laws that benefit the lobbyists, that benefit the corporations, that benefit the corporate interests. And so I can understand things like voter ID laws, you know, because, hey, you have fewer Democratic voters, you get more Republican legislation. Republican legislation tends to be very corporate friendly. But I don't understand why a group that exists to advance the interests of, you know, the billionaires and the corporations in our society would be pushing a law that, you know, has in the state of Florida almost tripled the justifiable homicide rate.
Let me answer your question, Tom, because unfortunately there is an answer. Let's begin with the fact that we've always, going back to before the founding of the United States through common law, had self-defense protection.
Sure.
And there are instances, and there may even be instances where somebody, you know, people get all excited about a shooting that has occurred, and actually it was legitimate self-defense. That will happen sometimes, and we have to be careful not to convict people in those situations.
Right.
But let's ask why we went to this extreme of having so-called Castle Doctrine or Stand Your Ground laws, which take self-defense out of the household, put it in the street, and say that not only do you have a right to defend yourself, you don't have to retreat. You don't have to, you know, try and protect yourself. You can just shoot. Why are we going to these extreme laws? Well, the fact of the matter is that beginning in Florida in 2005, with the passage of this law, there has been a national push by the National Rifle Association and ALEC, making this a scored bill, i.e. one that legislators get extra credit. They get extra points within ALEC if they sponsor it. It's a very highly promoted piece of legislation. And the answer to your question, unfortunately, is that on the Criminal Justice Task Force, now the Elections and Public Safety Task Force of ALEC, sits not just the NRA and legislators, not just a representative of the Koch brothers, but also Walmart. And Walmart has been very, very involved in that because Walmart is the number one gun seller in the United States.
Really?
And, yeah, more guns are sold at Walmart than any place else.
Now, I, you know, the last time I was in Walmart was when I lived in Vermont, and it was the only store within 100 miles that sold a pillow. And so I walked into a Walmart and bought a pillow. But and I remember walking by the gun department in that Walmart in Vermont, and it was mostly long rifles. I mean, you know, it was for hunters.
Mm-hmm. Well, remember, in cases like this, you can have a long rifle or a pistol. But if you go back to Michael Moore's film, Bowling for Columbine,
right.
If you recall back there, it was, in fact, he highlighted the fact that these major retailers are also major gun sellers.
So Walmart is selling pistols. They're selling semi-automatic pistols.
They're selling a lot of guns.
This guy had Tel 9, you know, Tel-Kel 9. It's a handgun. I mean, it's a semi-automatic.
Yeah, be careful here, Tom. I don't want to characterize exactly the gun, you know, where a gun came from.
Right.
I'm telling you why certain interests.
So Walmart is the number one gun seller in America, and they sit on this ALEC council along with Republican state legislators that is pushing this law so more people will buy guns so they can kill people?
No, Tom. You might think that, but it's actually something altogether different. There's a lot of liability with gun sales, or there potentially could be liability with gun sales.
Suppose
you sell a gun that goes and is in fact used in a horrific incident where ultimately there has to be a huge payout. And let's say the family isn't satisfied simply with holding a neighborhood watch and an unemployed member of a neighborhood watch team to account. They'd like to know where the gun came from. There's just a host of issues where things track.
So these so-called castle laws that Walmart and the NRA are promoting through the American Legislative Exchange Council, do they explicitly diminish liability, or is it simply the fact that nobody gets prosecuted?
Tom, there is no better way to diminish liability than the fact that police say it was justifiable.
You're right.
That you, under the laws of your jurisdiction, it was appropriate.
So this is a get-out-of-jail-free card, not just for people like George Zimmerman, but also for Walmart.
Well, potentially. And it's one of the reasons, again, we don't have to make this as complex or, you know, go to every intricate detail on it. What we have to understand is that there are corporations that have historically made a lot of money selling guns, guns and selling guns.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, okay, got it, John. John Nichols, thenation.com. John, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, sir.
Good talking with you.
It's crazy, crazy, crazy. Tell me that you don't care. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. Stopping at this warfare. It's crazy, crazy, crazy.
Welcome back. Is it crazy that a scientist can be a creationist? Doc, listening to WWRL in Jersey City, New Jersey, has some thoughts on this. Hey, Doc, what's up?
How are you, Tom? I really do love your show, and I think that you have a unique show. It's not a lot of people who are as informed historically as you are.
Thank you.
It's very good. I just want to make I wasn't sure if you said if you're a creationist and a scientist, or if you were a scientist believing that the universe was created, because the modern founders of science were all individuals who believed that the universe was created. Newton, Galileo, Leibniz, Kepler, Maxwell, Faraday. I can go down the line.
Sure.
The fact is that they established modern science. In fact, the modern scientific method is really the Galilean method. And I really don't want to comment too much on that. I just wanted to.
My comment wasn't about the history of science or arguably religion was the first effort at science, right? Is an effort to explain what's going on around us. And,
correct.
You know, thousands of years ago, the Norwegians looked up and saw what looked like a spear flying through the sky, lightning bolt, and they said, oh, that must be Thor throwing his spear, you know, or hitting his hammer against the anvil, and it's the sparks flying off. And, you know, that was science for its time. My question was, how can somebody who is a scientist and works in a scientific environment with other scientists, and who believes that the world is 5 or 6,000 years old and was created by an intelligent designer, and every detail in it is the result of the thought of that creator, and that creator is male with a penis, and has a whole list of rules for everybody.
My understanding of ID is that it's not that at all.
No, intelligent design is creationism dressed up. It's creationism and drag.
Tom, I don't believe that for one reason. I think that what you look at when you see a configuration and you see that it's patterned, you can say that this was intelligently configured.
Right.
Now, they do this in forensics. They do this in something called design science, which I think one of the pioneers was Buckminster Fuller. One of my math instructors, Jay Kaproff, has a book, Connections, that a book in design science. It has nothing to do with intelligent design, but it's what they use today. It's basically a confluence or a convergence of various art and science and different approaches to understanding patterning.
Right.
But that's really not.
But my point about intelligent design, if you want to just argue intelligent design, we could do that for a second, Doc.
Yeah,
my point about it is.
That's really not what I called. I called about a labor party. I think we need a labor party in the. But I'll get back to that if you'd like. That's another.
Well, the point that I wanted to make is that I think that they're confusing cause with effect. If you look at Darwinian evolution, you have hundreds of thousands of micro events that lead to one ultimate macro event, and that is the changing of a species. Our species.
That's another thing. I don't want to get into that because do you know that the first people who questioned orthodox, hardline Darwinists were mathematicians? And there was a reason for that, but I can't get into that now because that's a topic for another show. But I,
all right.
I think
so you
that
want
that
to talk about
another allergy.
Yeah.
I think what we need in this country, and what I've become disheartened is I hear certain people say, you know, we're really disappointed by Obama and his election and what he was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And I can't help but think they've been extremely naive. What did they expect? If you work, what we don't need, and I agree with you that many times on your show you say you should get at the lowest level of the Democratic Party, get involved. I agree with that. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. However, I don't think we should ever depend on the Democratic Party to represent working class people. We need an American Labor Party. And by playing footsie with the Democrats, we don't really get anywhere.
Doc, if the entire country was like New York and had fusion voting, I would agree
mm-hmm.
with you. Totally. If a candidate could run on two different parties at the same time, like Jack Kennedy did when he ran on the Democratic Party ticket in New York and the Progressive Party. In fact, he might have been on the Labor Party as well. He might have been on multiple ones. I know that he was on the Progressive Party ticket. I've got the speech that he gave when he said, I'm proud to be a progressive. The Liberal Party. I'm proud to be a liberal. But most of the rest of the country doesn't allow that. So anyhow, I got to move along, Doc. I got a lot of other calls here. Thank you very much for the call and thought-provoking conversation. Steve, listening in Albuquerque, New Mexico on KABQ. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I had a question about the Trevon case. I was wondering, usually you have to prove innocence or guilt or whatever in a court of law.
Right.
But in this case, it seemed like explanation to the police was sufficient.
Because of this law that was pushed through by the NRA, Walmart, and ALEC, then that was enthusiastically signed into law by Jeb Bush. Yes.
Uh-huh.
And what this law says is all you have to do is say to the police, I killed him because I thought I was at risk, even though I'm standing out here in the street, and I chose not to run away feeling at risk. I chose to pull my gun and shoot, and that's now legal in Florida.
I'm not a constitutional scholar, but that kind of seems unconstitutional or something.
It does
like that
seem to deny due process, which is guaranteed by the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendments of the Constitution. Yes,
yeah.
I agree with you, and I'm not a constitutional scholar either, but I don't think you have to be one. I think we can be lay scholars or lay constitutionalists and agree on that. Thanks a lot for the call, Steve, and thanks for listening to KABQ. Dave, is it Ankeny, Iowa?
Ankeny, Iowa.
Okay, great. Thanks, Dave. Dave, we have just a minute before the break. What's up?
Okay, I agree with about 99% what you say, but gun control, as far, I'm a Democrat, but I believe in guns. I'm in the Midwest, and I have several guns myself, and most people I know do.
I believe
most
in guns.
Time,
what is that?
Most of the time, they don't cause this terrible thing that happened there.
You're
I listened to you yesterday and heard the lawyer explain what the law was there. And from my understanding, was that they have a right, or they're supposed to escape if they can in certain instances.
No.
I don't understand the law completely over there, but I had something like that happen here. And I had a kid break into my garage at 2 o'clock in the morning. I went out with my gun to confront whoever it was because the alarm went off. He didn't want to obey what I did. I didn't shoot him, but I did get him arrested from that. But he was going to try to run. I shot a round into the ground, let him know that I was serious. So he stopped. Turns out to be a black male. It didn't matter to me who it was, and I was scared that he had something in his coat.
Right.
But I did stop him, and he was arrested.
Okay.
I got cited for firing a gun within the city.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dave, thanks for the call, and thanks for telling your story. But you didn't kill a guy, and good on you at least for that. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very sanguinivoriously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for your brain. The good. Montana Judge James Reynolds. On Tuesday, Reynolds rejected a Republican-backed ballot initiative that aimed to help conservatives in Montana's Supreme Court elections. The initiative would have established regional districts that would elect one justice to the Supreme Court. And since much of the state is conservative, more conservatives would have been elected to the Supreme Court. Reynolds said in his ruling that the initiative would change the Montana Constitution by adding new candidate requirements for Supreme Court justices and therefore was constitutional. So it's not enough that conservatives are controlling our legislatures. Now they're controlling our courts. Good on you, Judge Reynolds, for standing up to this latest conservative ploy. The bad. The Los Angeles City Council. The Los Angeles City Council has become the first city in the country to approve a resolution calling on local TV and radio stations to limit racist and sexist comments on their broadcasts. The resolution urges the management of radio stations and television stations in Los Angeles to do everything in their power to ensure that their on-air hosts do not use and promote racist and sexist slurs over the public airwaves in the city of Los Angeles. End quote. I'm usually on the side of liberals, and I'm just as offended by racist comments and sexist comments like those made by Rush as anybody else. But when we give the government the power to determine what's considered offensive political speech, it's a slippery slope. I just wonder how long it would be before they came after me for calling Dick Cheney a war criminal. And the very, very ugly Senator John Thune. In the wake of the Trayvon Martin tragedy, Senator Thune and his fellow Republican colleagues are trying to turn America into the wild, wild west. Along with 28 other Republican senators, Thune introduced a bill yesterday that would allow people authorized to carry a concealed weapon in their home state to carry it in all other concealed carry states. It would enable residents of states with lax gun laws to carry concealed firearms nearly anywhere in the country, basically eliminating a state's control over who is able to have a firearm in that state. You would think the Martin tragedy would be a reason to prevent further gun violence in America. Instead, Senator Thune is trying to fill our streets with more senseless killings. And that's very, very ugly. Boy, that's amazingly ugly. And my mouse is wet. Oh, my. Spilled my glass of Edison Factor on the table here. Bill in Clifton, New Jersey, listening on WWRL. Hey, Bill, what's going on?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
First of all, my religion is physics, and that's as far as I go.
Okay.
I was the guy who called some time ago. I was all worried about the physiology of conservatives. I've changed my mind on that.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that they are what happened to the Neanderthals. And they split off from modern man when they refused to believe fire could exist. And they also had cornered the market on woolly mammoth dung, hot dung, which they delivered to caves, to heat people's caves. So they had they didn't want to get involved in that. And that's where they spun off.
Did you ever read, apparently you've never read Darwin's Radio, the science fiction novel?
No. I haven't.
I'm forgetting the author, but it was an amazing book. It was based on the premise, and this is scientific fact, that our brains are around, typically the average human Homo sapiens brain size is around 1,500 cc's volume. And Greg Bear was the author. And the Neanderthals' brains were around 1,650 cc's. In other words, they had larger brains than us. And so the theory that Greg Bear puts forward in the radio, in Darwin's radio, and it's brilliant, is that they were actually more highly evolved than us, and they were telepathic. They were able, or something close to it, and we killed them off because we were the brutes, and they were unwilling to participate in brutality. And the scientific evidence does demonstrate, A, they had larger brains, and B, we did kill them off. You know, in Europe, and yeah, during the Ice Age, right, and, you know, 30,000 years ago. So, you know, maybe, and here's the final piece of it. They've now, and this is just in the last 5 years, and I think Greg Bear probably wrote that book 10, 15 years ago, but just in the last 5 years, they've taken the Neanderthal genome and broken, you know, decoded a large chunk of it, and the Neanderthals had red hair. And the gene for red hair in the human genome appears to have come from crossbreeding with the Neanderthals. We have a small percentage of our DNA as Neanderthal, and the red hair gene seems to be a piece of that. And so, you know, apparently they were pretty cool.
Scandinavia.
So what can you say? So I don't think they were the conservatives.
Right. May I mention one other thing?
Sure.
Yeah. Why is it when a rule that when a law is proposed or brought before the floor, there is a provenance from it? There's an authorship. They have to announce on the floor, this was written by Alec, backed by the Koch brothers. And when it's on a ballot, people have to see who authored it, who plagiarized it, or where it originally came from.
That would put Alec out of business.
What's that?
I mean, that would put Alec out of business. I would love to see legislation like that. You know, at the federal level, but, you know, we don't have that right now, tragically. Bill, thanks a lot for listening. I appreciate it. Norma in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Norma, what's up?
Tom, I was calling about the Trayvon Martin case, and I told your person that I was just thinking about it from the perspective of a parent, specifically a black parent, and just, I just felt their pain, and I, as a black parent myself, I know. And I have a son. It is incredibly difficult and challenging to raise a black male in this country. This boy was not a gangbanger. He was just an innocent kid, like your son, just walking down the street.
Yeah.
And these parents did everything they could to raise a good son.
Yeah.
And he was taken like that. And that is my worst fear. And my son is 26 years old, and I still fear for him being caught in a situation like that. And I don't think the average American understands that difficulty and that challenge and that constant fear that as a black parent you have for your son.
Yep. I don't think that most Americans, most white Americans, you know, I said to Joe Madison at the beginning of this show, I don't think 90% of white Americans have ever heard the phrase white privilege or have any kind of serious understanding of what it means.
Oh my God. You're so right. You're so right. And I mean, my husband and I, we've done everything we possibly could to raise a good man. And the fact that I still have to worry about him and then to hear this happen to this young man and this family.
Yes.
It's just heartbreaking, and it makes me angry, and the loss, the tragic loss of a wonderful human.
Yes. Yes. Norma, thank you for sharing your experience and your perspective.
Thank you. I
do appreciate it. And this is how we as a nation evolve and heal, is listening to the stories of touching the hearts of the people who have been historically characterized as the other. I think it's what happened in Europe with after the Holocaust, you know, with many Europeans' perspective on Jews. It's what is it is in pieces happened in the United States over the years with the Holocaust of Native Americans and the slavery Holocaust of you know, the history of this country. But we are so far from healed from this. We have so far to go. It's just remarkable. Steve in Fort Chiswell, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I'm a Republican, belong to the NRA, and this is an obvious manslaughter case.
It seems at the very least to be manslaughter, and if this guy was out looking for an opportunity to kill a young black man, I would submit it as it's first-degree murder.
I don't think he was. There's no way to prove that he was out, set out to kill anybody that night. But obviously,
well, he was carrying a gun, and he was talking to the police on the phone, and he called the kid a racial slur, and he said they always get away. And I mean, you know, I think that the tapes, you know, the audio tapes are enough evidence that this was a racially motivated murder, and. Frankly, that in my mind, that's first-degree murder. I don't know what a prosecutor would say, but in my mind, it is. Matt in Wilbur, Kentucky. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I have a question a little off-topic for today, but I've been reading the Tom Hartman Reader and getting a little sample of a lot of different things you've written.
Yeah.
And one of the topics is regarding democracy being...
genetic.
Yes.
It's in our
absolutely.
Genes.
And, you know, it talks about trickle-down economics and Reaganomics and how bankrupting Social Security put us on the path that we're on now. Mm-hmm. My question is, and I'm totally on board with you, absolutely agree, but at the point where we decide to increase taxes for the rich, and, you know, I feel like it can't be a drastic change. You can't just totally make a flip. But when you do,
Abraham Lincoln did.
Think about it this way: if all of these, you know, billionaires, millionaires realize that next year they're going to be taxed at a higher rate, they sell off the stock they've got to prevent paying those extra taxes.
No, that's not what happened in the 1930s when FDR took the top tax on millionaires and billionaires in today's dollars from the 25% it had been at. Where Hoover in 1921, or excuse me, Harding in 21 had dropped it from 90% down to 25%, and it had stayed there until 1935. And when FDR raised it up to 91% over about a three-year period, what happened was the very wealthy people simply stopped taking very large paychecks, and you went to a 30-to-1 ratio between the CEOs and the workers.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's like people think that story that is told in Atlas Shrugged, that the rich people are going to go on strike and somehow it's going to destroy the country, is possible. It's not possible. It's never happened.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay.
Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Marcel watching us on Free Speech TV down in Louisiana. Hey, Marcel, what's up?
Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. What's on your mind?
Well, yeah, I just flipped through the channel, heard you guys are talking about the Zimmerman shooting, and it just seems like all I hear about is cops killing people.
This guy wasn't a cop. George Zimmerman was not a cop.
Well, he was some sort of security officer employed
and
by
he was
a organization.
No, not true. He was a volunteer community watch guy. The this was a gated community, and it had a neighborhood association. And typically, neighborhood associations like attend to things like, can you paint your house that color, right?
Yeah.
And
well,
one of the things
even worse if that's the case.
And one of the things that this community had never done before was to have, you know, volunteer neighborhood watch. And neighborhood watches are, you know, there's a long history of them in the United States going back probably 100 years, probably going back to the KKK and before that. But in any case, this guy, George Zimmerman, volunteered to be, at no pay, to be the neighborhood watch guy. And he was a self-appointed vigilante. That's what he was. This had nothing to do with the police. The problem here is that when the police came upon the scene of a murder where a young man who was armed with a bag of Skittles and a can of iced tea was laying on the ground, and a guy standing over him was holding a Kel-Tel 9 semi-automatic 9mm weapon, and the kid was dead. That they drug tested the kid's body, but they didn't drug test or alcohol test the guy who shot him. They didn't seriously question him. When witnesses to the thing came forward and said the kid was screaming, help me, when the guy shot him, they said, oh, no, you must have been hearing the wrong person. I mean, the police did not want to hear the narrative that this young black man was innocent. That's the problem.
I agree with you. It's an awful tragedy. My main point was, shouldn't everyone, including what you call vigilantes and even the police, because I'm from Los Angeles, you know, I grew up in Northern California. Don't get me started on LAPD and what the Bay Area police do to people. But shouldn't the police and everyone else that wants to do anything always think twice, or maybe even think three times, that maybe that person over there is armed and I shouldn't do this and I should not pull a weapon out?
Well, I think the police always think that, and that's one of the reasons why they pull weapons out a whole lot faster than they probably should in many circumstances.
Yeah, and, but time after time.
And if all the rest of us start thinking that, then you've got the NRA wet dream.
When he's on the ground getting shot, man.
I'm sorry.
Think about it. He was killed without a weapon. That's exactly what the Founding Fathers were talking about.
No,
they
it's not.
The police and the state,
no,
or
it's not.
Vigilantes or criminals,
no, it's not.
Are in control when the government disarms people.
If you're talking about the Second Amendment, go back and read Thomas Jefferson's letters to James Madison, in which he demanded the Second Amendment. He demanded, in fact, he demanded all 10 amendments to the Constitution. And he said that he would pull the state of Virginia from the Constitutional Convention if Madison didn't introduce a Bill of Rights. And Madison didn't want
to
do it.
That's what they were trying to avoid. This situation is what they were trying to avoid.
And read the letters and then call this program back. Or read the Constitution of Pennsylvania in 1776, because it had a constitution at that time. And what Jefferson wanted to model the Second Amendment after. The original draft of the Second Amendment. Read Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. The original draft of the Second Amendment said that standing armies are a known source of pernicious something or other in society. And what they were talking about was that they had seen time after time that during time of peace, armies had overthrown civilian governments, and they did not want that to happen in the United States. And so the Second Amendment, just like the Pennsylvania Constitution, said there shall be no standing army during time of peace. There will be a Coast Guard, a Navy, but no standing army. And when that standing army is dissolved, it is replaced by a citizen militia under the control of local authorities and answerable to state authorities. And in order for that militia to be a well-regulated militia, the right of citizens to carry arms shall not be abridged. And back in those days, the local citizen militias kept their arms, not in their houses, but in the local armory. And that was what they were talking about. And they were not talking about self-defense. They were not talking about a nation of Davy Crockett's. They were not talking about everybody having a gun to shoot their neighbor. This was a very lightly populated, small, you know, largely agricultural, rural country at that time. And what they were talking about was making sure that there was never a military industrial complex that would rise up and threaten the nation itself, the civilian nation.
How do we protect ourselves from authoritarian figures killing unarmed people? That's my question, I guess.
You do it with a force of moral authority. How did Gandhi get the British out of India?
By sacrificing pain and lots of it.
That's right. How did Martin Luther King get the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act passed, and end lynching
peacefully
in the South?
Peacefully.
Yes, that's how you do it. You don't do it by sticking a gun in somebody's face. That just perpetuates the cycle of violence. If you're really genuinely brave and you genuinely...
I want to prevent that.
I'm sorry?
I just want to prevent people sticking guns in people's faces, you know?
Then, let's look at countries like Switzerland where people don't stick guns in your face because it's illegal to have a gun unless you can prove that you need it.
And Switzerland has state-funded shooting competitions.
Yep, absolutely. And you have to have a permit. Their attitude toward a gun license, and most European countries... In fact, I think all the European countries, is that, you know, owning a gun is not that different from owning a car. You've got to demonstrate competence, and you've got to demonstrate a need to have it. And if you can demonstrate that, then you can have a license to do that. That seems to me common sense.
Yeah, in Switzerland, actually the gun nuts worship Switzerland's policy. They really do. They think it's great.
Yeah, that you have to have a license to own a gun.
Yeah, and Switzerland has awesome little videos, you know, like in edited documentaries and whatnot about their statewide shooting competition.
Oh yeah, they're very into it. It again requires a license. Why don't we do that here in the United States? I don't think that George Zimmerman would have gotten a license if we were serious about it. This is a guy who in 2005 was arrested for assaulting a police officer. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders will be here for an hour of Q&A, a national town hall meeting where you have an opportunity to call the United States Senator and ask anything you want. And it should be a lot of fun. And, of course, Anything Goes Friday. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. It takes all of us. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.